I tell my children all the time, it's very normal to be scared. It's okay. But you do have to get comfortable with doing things while you're scared. The other person's scared too, I promise. They're either scared or crazy.
Yeah.
And crazy doesn't make you tough. No matter where
That's
you're
very
from,
true.
no matter how people act, tough is tough. You can get someone who's a farmer from Iowa, and you'll get someone from the inner city. Tough doesn't know where you're from.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This is Powerful with me, Paul Scholfor. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery, or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Today's guest welcomes the tough times as an opportunity to grow. The tougher, the better. Ken Rideout is the fastest marathon runner in the world, over 50, a former prison guard, a Wall Street trader, and former opioid addict. His life has been chronicled in such publications as the New York Times, Outside, and the Wall Street Journal. Since getting sober more than a decade ago, he's won some of the world's toughest races, including age 52, the Gobi March, a 155-mile self-supported race across the Gobi Desert in Mongolia in sweltering heat, and a few months later, the Masters Marathon World Championships for over 50s. Ken lives in Nashville with his wife and his four children. Ken, it's really lovely to have you on This is Powerful.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate you.
Yeah, it's really, really good, mate. I could talk to you for hours as we've already been talking. I've got loads and loads of questions, but you know, you're incredibly successful. You're the fastest marathon runner. We're the same age. You did that at 52.
Yeah.
That's incredible and very inspiring. You come from being a prison guard. Come from a place called Somerville, which I looked at online, and you described the houses, these three-story houses, and it was a shithole.
Yeah.
They're a nice design. I thought they looked quite nice now.
They're like utilitarian shitholes. They're like three-story, triple-decker houses. Three families lived in them, one on each floor. And they were built poorly and quickly. And yeah, it sucked. It was like living in like sardine cans. It was like the equivalent of like New York City tenement buildings, just utilitarian.
I was trying to think of a place in London where I could relate to it. And I think it's Canning Town, which is a place in East London where my father came from. And like worldwide delivery services wouldn't deliver there, even though they'd deliver to Iraq because it was so bad because people would blow the vans up. And then you battled addiction, you came through that, and you've got two big firms going and a podcast going. And I read your book, well, I listened to your book because I'm dyslexic, and it's one of the best books I've listened to in a long time. And
thank you.
No, seriously, and we shared before that it is your voice. I could relate to it. I felt like I was in an intimate conversation with you. I loved your humility through it. And what I related to was your, we was talking about what toxic masculinity is before, right? But I found like you're a brilliant definition of what a real man is.
Oh, thank you.
Like generally.
Might be the nicest compliment I've gotten since I wrote the book.
Yeah, no, seriously. Loving, caring, but super strong.
Mm.
Great mindset, open. But yeah, so it's an absolute definite read. And we put that all on the show notes because I think a lot of men should read that.
Well, thank you, man. I appreciate it. I'm just like surviving. I'm just doing my best.
But that's the bit about the humble bit, you know. You don't have to shout it all out. It's actions seem to be what you do rather than talking about stuff. So on This is Powerful, we usually start at the beginning. Mm. I'd love you to tell us a little bit about your upbringing.
Yeah. I grew up in the inner city, like you described, in Somerville, in, you know, like very similar to what a tenement would look like in New York, I think. And, you know, for context, I worked as a guard in the prison when I was 18, when I got out of high school, which I guess would be like college over here. And for context, my stepfather had been an inmate in the prison where I was now working, and my brother, who's 11 months younger, would eventually end up serving time there for different types of crimes. He's career criminal, in and out of prison, never had a job. So that was the environment I was living in. But even while I was living there, I still had the similar mindset that I had now. Like, I want nice things in my life. I wanted to be a winner. And I was surrounded by losers. And it was terrible. There's no, like, way to sugarcoat it. I hated it.
You said it really eloquently in your book about that I felt I could identify with a hopeless upbringing. Like, he was either going to work in a factory. My mum would say to me, well, you're never going to work in a bank, so
yeah,
you're going to be a construction worker, or you're going to do something like that.
Yeah.
And I always had this feeling that I was not going to settle for that. There's always more. There's something over the horizon.
Mm.
Do you think you was born with that, Ken? Or do you
yes.
think, yeah.
Because I felt the same way. I always felt like, no, I'm destined for bigger things than this, to the point where I think at times they, you know, well, I say in the book, they would tell me that I was conceited and arrogant and thought that I was better than them. And I, truthfully, I did. I was like, yeah, I'm not supposed to be here. I don't even know how I'm related to you guys.
I shared with someone once. I said, when I was born, I opened my eyes and I thought, where's the red carpet? What's going on?
But someone made a mistake.
Yeah. How did you navigate that? Because, for me personally, I didn't really have anyone around me that was working in the city or was in the film industry or did something outside of that box. I had some uncles that drove nice cars and had money and did things I probably wouldn't do when I was older.
Yeah.
But did you have anyone that inspired you in a way or gave you a way out?
No, I had no mentors, no role models. I had no idea. I had no one modeling like the behavior I was looking for. I just knew, I don't know if it was from TV or from, like, you know, I played hockey competitively my whole life. And as a kid, we would travel to other towns to play their hockey team. And I'd see the nice houses and be like, I want to live like this. I want my yard to have, like, not have a crashed up motorcycle in it and shitty cars. Like, I want it to be nice and orderly. And maybe that speaks to my, like, controlling nature or OCD, that I just like everything neat and clean. When my wife and I were first married, we lived in a beautiful penthouse apartment in New York City, and brand new. It was gorgeous. It was furnished perfectly, and when we were selling it, the people would come through and be like, wow, who staged the apartment? And I'm like, this ain't staged. This is how we live, man. Like, there's no clutter here. Everything's put where it's supposed to be. That's how I relax. It's like, yeah, everything is great. You know, everything is orderly.
I totally get that.
Which is difficult when you have four kids now, because I'm like, who left this effing milk out for the third time? Who didn't put the cereal away? It's just, and then I catch myself and I'm like, I'm a monster.
Yeah, I've got two kids. I had to have a whole, my wife sat me down and was like, this isn't your apartment. This isn't your bachelor pad.
Yeah.
The kids need to run around. So I had to make a deal with myself. That yeah. I'm like, okay, fine. So we had a room in the center of the house. It was the dining room.
Mm.
Is now their room. And anything can go on in that room. I love the, you described in the book about your coach, but the conversation you had when he benched you and your defiance. Can you just talk us through that? Because there's a lot of our listeners, I love to know about character building and defiance and resilience and stuff. That sounded like a really bad moment for you.
Yeah, oh, I hated that guy, man. I hated what he did. Because I think in hindsight, he could have been a better man and sat me down and had a real talk with me instead of, like, shit-canning me. He, you know, he probably just was like, I'm benching for a game. I wasn't playing very well. I mean, we're not talking about, like, the highest level of hockey here. And he sat me down. He benched me for a game, which wasn't uncommon if someone wasn't playing well. And I was like, F this guy. I'm not even going to go to watch the game then. And then he benched me the next game, and then I didn't show up again. And then he benched me a third time and said, if you don't come this time, you're not going to be on this team anymore. And then I went to the game, and, you know, and I realized I was being a jerk, of course. Like, I'm not stupid. And But I was like, yeah, maybe I won't even play next year. And I was kind of like on the fence. And then next year rolled around and I'm like, well, I don't have anything without hockey. And so I went, I was like, okay, I'm going to show up at the tryouts. And I think he kind of caught wind that I wasn't really into it at the end of the last season. And we weren't very good. And but I went through and tried out, and he cut me from the team, and it was shocking. I had never, like, that in my wildest dreams, I wouldn't have imagined being cut. Man, I wanted to stab him. But he was like, you know, this is what I did, and I thought you could have like handled this much different. It made a meaningful difference in my life. Obviously, I was like a young guy who needed guidance and could have used some actual coaching and mentorship. And instead of recognizing that, he just like cast me aside, which, okay, I get it. Like, that's, I fucked up. I had to deal with it. No problem. But I just think as an adult, he was a dad himself. Like, he could have made a bigger difference in my life. And unfortunately, it caused me to spiral and get into much more into drugs than I was. And I think he missed an opportunity to play a meaningful role in my life. I mean, I turned that adversity into a strength in the long run, but it wasn't without lots of pain.
You said that at that time you had a good connection with your father.
I would say we had a connection, you know. It was unhealthy based on sports.
But was it because he kind of applauded you when you was doing well in hockey, that kind of thing? Or
I wouldn't say he applauded me for doing well. He loved having something to do and, like, you know, living vicariously through me with the sports. But I wouldn't say it was like a good, healthy relationship. He probably thought it was good because he was getting what he wanted from it, but it was like, you know, listening to him try and like tell me what I did wrong and didn't do wrong was always like, oh, you know, when you don't think someone really knows that much about something and they're trying to tell you how to do something. Like, with my children, I always say, your kids will hear some of what you say, but they'll see, but they'll believe everything you show them. Yeah. And it's hard to be telling someone how they should play or what they should do when you haven't done anything that you're trying to advise on.
Most boxing fans are like that.
I just ran this morning with Shane McGuigan.
Oh, did you?
You know the trainer? Yeah. His dad was Barry McGuigan.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, he ran with me at 6 a.m., came in. No way. He's a good friend of mine, yeah.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, I met his dad a couple of times because I used to box. And I boxed for the British title a couple of times, and he was there. So I was like a young kid, like getting a picture with Barry McGuigan.
Yeah, no, I had a boxing show for a long time with Teddy Atlas called The Fight with Teddy Atlas, and we interviewed like loads of champions, every champion from the UFC. Matter of fact, Tom Aspinall, the heavyweight champ of the UFC, he just sent me a DM this morning. He saw that I was here and invited me to do his podcast in Manchester, but I have to go home tomorrow. But that was cool. Like, I'm a big fan. I love UFC. I'm friends with Dana White. Like, I just...
Really?
Yeah.
He seems like a really cool fella.
I saw him at a fight in Nashville where I live, and I was I had like, you know, VIP seats, and Dana has his own section. And friends of friends were there, and we interviewed him on the podcast before, so I knew him. And I was talking to him. I was like, oh, my youngest son, he's into jiu-jitsu and wrestling, he wants to fight in the UFC, he's 8. And Dana was like, bring him to Boston next week, I got you, come sit in my section. So we went there, and my son is sitting in the front row of the VIP section. Like, we're sitting in front of like the coach of the Boston Celtics. Like, we were in the best seat. And my son had his Celtics jersey on and his Irish like leprechaun style hat. And Dana's stomping through the backstage area where all the, like, you know, kind of celebrities are coming in, all the VIPs, and Dana's just rushing through. But he sees my son comes running over. He's like, Cameron, thanks for coming. Like he's like a mega celebrity. And my son is just like on cloud nine. Then in between the main and the co-main event, Dana comes over, takes my phone, takes my son, brings him around the octagon, takes a picture of him with Joe Rogan, has Bruce Buffer, the announcer, holding his hand up, pointing at my son with his Celtics jersey on. He's got like green Air Jordans on, like dressed like a little leprechaun in Boston, and then brings him into the octagon right before the main events. So, you know, early in the night, all the seats aren't filled. At the main event, the place is packed, and there's my son standing in the octagon with his hands up, and Dana takes his picture, and my son's like, the next time you see me in the octagon, I'm not going to have my shoes on. And amazing. I was just, Dana gave me one of the best nights of my life, and I don't know him well enough to have warranted such wonderful behavior.
But that's a real gentleman, isn't it?
Yes, and that's what I'm telling you. That guy, he catches some shit on online sometimes, but I'm telling you, he did not have to do that for like a little kid or for me or for anyone else. But anytime I've ever asked him for anything, which is very rarely, he comes through in spades, like overboard kind.
But that for me is a man with a mindset that's experienced in life, and he knows what that would mean to you, his father, and to Cameron.
And he's from Boston, right? So then we're sitting there with Peter Welch, who has a famous boxing gym in Boston, and my friend Irish Mickey Ward, who, you know, fought Arturo Gatti three times. They made the movie The Fighter about him. He was actually a guard with me at the prison the same time I worked there. And his brother, Dickie Eklund, who fought Sugar Ray Leonard, was played by Christian Bale in the movie. He was an inmate at the prison.
Sugar Ray Leonard was one of my favorite boxers.
Yeah. He lived near me in Pacific Palisades. I used to see him all the time. Really? Very small town in L.A., a small area of
town. I know it very well.
Yeah.
I lived just behind Chateau Marmont when I was there.
Oh, okay. For a long time. That's the fancy part. We were over there.
I think Palisades is a fancy part. But we know it is.
Yeah, man. But yeah, I love all combat sports, and I've been super lucky to be friends with guys like Dustin Poirier and Regis Progre, like loads of world champions.
I love the way, what I found will give a lot of people strength, in especially in your book, is that you can come from somewhere like where you come from without an education. And if you've got the kahunas to do it and the wits, and not, you're clearly an intelligent man, you can go places far. And can you tell us about how you got out of Somerville when you got the job? Was it the pharmaceutical one first?
Yeah.
And how that led on to go to New York?
Yeah, I was, when I got out of college, when I finished university, I didn't know what I was going to do, and because I wanted to play hockey my whole life. And when that was over, I was like kind of floundering. And a friend was like selling pharmaceuticals. He was like, oh, I'm making like 40 grand. And you know, at the time that was like really good money. This is in like 1996, '97. And he had a friend who was a hiring manager at a pharmaceutical company, like second or third tier pharmaceutical company. And long story short, I got a job as a sales rep for a pharmaceutical company, which is you basically work from home and go out and sell, convince doctors to sell your, to write scripts for your pharmaceutical drugs. And they have ways of measuring it. It's all like, I was the worst salesman in history. I would like sleep all day, get up, go to the gym, call on a couple doctors a couple days a week. But because they were already writing certain scripts, like it almost was like running by itself. So there was only so much I could influence. I hated it. I didn't hate it, but I wasn't good at it. And I don't like doing jobs like half-assed. And I was playing hockey in Chelsea Piers, like in a men's league. And one of the guys there was working on a commodities trading desk and said they needed a trading assistant. And I was like, oh yeah, I want to work in finance. These young guys that I knew with from the gym and stuff were all making loads of money. And I was like, they seem like idiots. And if they can make money, like anyone can. So I got the job, and very quickly, like, well, I got the job, and then they were hazing, almost like bullying me, which is crazy. I was boxing for the New York Athletic Club. I was like in good shape. I wasn't like a pushover. And the guy threw a dry erase at me one day while I was writing on the writing the prices up on the board, trying to keep up with all the screaming and yelling. And he threw a dry erase at me, and I slapped the shit out of him. I just slapped him across the face, and they fired me, obviously. And within 48 hours, I had a job at a competitor, because one of the big time traders at Enron heard the story and loved it and called me. And now I got a new job at a trading desk, making twice as much money covering the biggest customer in the world. And it was just on from there. And it was just everything. My whole career took off, and I started making literally millions of dollars.
Yeah. When you talk about back in Somerville, your uncle had a heroin problem.
Yeah.
There was lots of drugs and stuff around you. When I was younger, alcohol was a lot around in my family. And I swore that I'm not going to go down that road. I'm not going to drink, because I saw the like good-looking, strapping guys who was doing really well, laughing, having fun, and then just being a mess, getting in fights, throwing up, being like these things on the floor, and I'm like, what is that stuff? I don't want to drink that when I'm older. Found myself doing the same thing. How did you start getting onto drinking drugs?
Yeah, well, I was always, you know, I always had like a fairly healthy relationship with drinking. I was like not a huge drinker. I was lucky. Like after a certain amount of drinks, I would get sick before I would be like a sloppy mess. I was never like, in that regard, I was lucky. But if I drank too much, I would throw up violently, and I hated that. So I always knew like I could drink X amount before it got ugly. And, but I had ankle surgery, and while I was living in New York, got some Percocet. And as soon as I took the Percocet, I was like, oh my God, this is the best feeling in the world. And to me, it was different than heroin because it was prescription, something I was prescribed. Like it didn't seem so taboo. But that quickly escalated, and I quickly understood that I have a serious like opioid addiction. And the shitty thing is, like, I was never, like, enjoying my addiction. I was never like, oh, I'm, like, so happy getting high. It very quickly became, like, the bane of my existence. It was the only thing I could think about when I went to sleep. It was the only thing I could think about when I woke up was either getting high or the fact that I hated myself because I was addicted. So it just was a nightmare. And took a lot of effort to get sober, and I was so afraid of going through these withdrawals, which I did several times. It took me 10 years to figure out, okay, this is a losing proposition. I have to change right now. But week to 2 weeks of withdrawals is so painful, I just put it off for 10 years.
You said, I couldn't believe when you said, I used to run around the park as well in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And, You said on there like that you'd still run when you was on the Percocet, and then you went on to something else after. How the hell did you do that? Because I know I used to, even through my addiction, I had a big cocaine issue. My thing wasn't really alcohol, it was more drugs.
Yeah.
And I would still, after having like a 3-day session, just go to the gym, get a sunbed, try and do my stuff. But I really battered myself. How did you do all the running on that? How'd that affect you?
Well, I didn't do a lot of running when I was on it. I'd exercise, but I wouldn't be like extensive. It was when I got sober and went through the withdrawals, I was running as almost like a form of penance. I was punishing myself, and because I didn't want to do it. And then it became a source of strength, and then it became a source of discipline. And then eventually I started to get faster at running, but I didn't set out to be a like win marathons or be a runner. I was just running to like run, probably running from problems and shit, and like avoiding doing the hard work of talking to a therapist.
It's become a massive strength and a massive thing for you to the running. I just touched on earlier, you made me laugh because you said about when it was a cold, rainy evening and you was walking home and you had some donkey dust, which is cocaine, and you said you felt great, and then you felt like you'd found something.
Yeah.
How was that? Because when I for our listeners, I've spoke about it before. Before then, I felt like I never fitted in.
Yeah.
Had massive anxiety issues. I'd always do stuff, and I'd turn up. Like when I was boxing, couldn't sleep for 2 or 3 nights because I was so anxious, playing over this fight.
That's everyone.
What I was doing. You think?
Yeah, everyone's scared of fighting. Even fighters. Then,
yeah, I didn't know that at the time. You know, I was young. And when I first started to compete, I was 14. And I didn't know about this mindset. Kind of like what you said about your hockey guy. My dad would basically look at me and say, "You look scared. Stop it. You're going to do this guy very quickly. And that's it." And that was my management thing for my dad.
That's
and
not good.
It wasn't good. And he's like, "You're just going to do this. You're going to be fine." And I remember fighting some guy who'd beat everyone in our gym. And I managed to beat him in the first round, don't know how, come out. And my dad was like, "Told you." And I thought, do you know what I've been through? Do you know how much fucking fear I've had? Yeah, it was quite interesting. But
I tell my children all the time, it's very normal to be scared. It's okay. But you do have to get comfortable with doing things while you're scared. That's the key, is everyone's scared. The other person's scared too, I promise. They're either scared or crazy.
Yeah.
And crazy doesn't make you tough. No matter where you're from, no matter how people act, tough is tough. You can get someone who's a farmer from Iowa who will rip your head off, and you'll get someone from the inner city screaming and yelling, posturing, acting like a lunatic. As soon as fists start flying, they're like out of there emotionally.
Yeah.
You know, tough doesn't know where you're from. Toughness is like something deep inside your heart that it's very hard to teach it, but you can teach it. You can make yourself tougher. When I was a kid, I don't think I was very tough. I kind of adopted a new toughness mindset and realized that it's always better to like fight and lose than to run away and avoid fighting. And that doesn't mean fist fighting. It means any kind of conflict. Like, it's always better to stop and deal with your addiction than to keep running from the truth and keep using drugs. Same thing as a fight. Fighting is just like a metaphor for life.
That is really beautifully put. I would crave to have read a book like yours when I was younger, because I really didn't have someone to coach me on anything. And I swore, and you wrote this in your book too, I swore when I was younger that I was going to be a good parent. And
yes.
I was going to invest in my kids. And I do, and it's not to say I'm like doing the best job, but if any of my girls come to me and ask me a question about anything, I'll sit down, look them in the eye, and I'll just go through the whole thing. And that's literally all I craved when I was a kid.
Yeah. No, listen, I'm with you. My children have all read my book. They know, they listened to it yesterday. My wife was in, they're on their spring break from school, so they had a week off, but I had to come here and do all the book stuff. Happened to release on the Tuesday of their week off from school. So we normally would take them somewhere, and we couldn't this year. So my wife took them to South Carolina from Nashville, which is like an 8-hour drive. So they listened to the book in the car. They've all read it, but they also listened to the book, and it was just interesting hearing the take. I know that they're super proud, but you know, they learned a lot about me, you know, and heard a lot about mistakes that I've made and things I'm not proud of. But that's, the book is my real story. And it's like some of the things in there, like one of my friends said, man, I can't believe you talked about some of these things. And I'm like, well, what do I care? Like, that's who I am. Like, what are you going to do? Like, tease me if you think I fucking care about your opinion? The only opinion of me that matters is my own. And when I was talking to them, they were in the car. I called and I was on the speaker, and my youngest son Cameron was like, Dad, it really doesn't even mention me. It just says my fourth son Cameron was born. And then my wife was brilliant. She said, you were in there a lot. The editors cut a lot of it out because they're trying to like streamline it, and they wanted to be about Dad and not just talking too much about his kids, because then it sounded like it was like not realistic. And he came with a beautiful excuse, and I was like, yeah, buddy, on the next one I'm gonna write all about you.
Oh, bless him.
Yeah, man, the kids are awesome.
You really touched me as well when you went to adopt,
yeah,
in Africa. And you said about, I loved it when you said the lawyer, you had to go to the court, the judge, and he's like, we can bus everyone in next week. And you're like, why? Can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, that was actually really funny. We were going in front of a Muslim female judge, and the lawyer was an older Ethiopian guy. And he said, listen, it's a very conservative judge. It's just a formality. Don't say anything. And they had told us after we adopt them, I was leaving the next day and my wife was staying. And they were like, we're going to bring all the kids up next week. They were down like 5 hours south in a place called Awasa. And I said, you know, like what we were saying about being British, like I just always speak up. Like I don't just accept things that I don't understand. So I said, why are you going to bring them up next week? Like if we go through the process right now and this gets done right now, why not bring them up tomorrow? He's like, oh, well, we bring them all up. We have a car arranged. We're paying for a car. I said, that's okay. I'll pay for a car right now. I'll pay for the whole car. Bring them all. Or I said, I'll pay to bring my daughter up. And he's like, well, we got to bring all the kids together. I go, okay, I'll pay for a whole van to bring everyone up. No, 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 we can't do that. And I was like, why can't you do it? And he didn't have an answer. So when we went in front of the judge, all formalities, yeah, blah, 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 blah. And then at the end, I was like, judge, can I say something? She's like, yeah. And I told her what I just told you. And I said, there's no need for these kids to stay at that orphanage down there. My wife's right here. My daughter is sick. She's like got an issue. Like I called the doctor in the U.S. They said this is what she needs. The judge looked at the lawyer and said, get the kids up here tomorrow. And he doesn't have to pay for it. You pay for it. Bring the kids. I want all the kids up here. All the other parents were like, yes. I said to my wife, I said, they're going to have a fucking parade for me. They're so happy. same thing when we were driving down there the first time to meet the kids in the orphanage. We were all in this van, and the driver, it was a two-lane highway through Ethiopia, and the guy kept passing trucks into the oncoming lane. And I could see the people in the back panicking, and I sit in the front seat. I always get in the front seat because I get car sick. Mm. So the guy goes at one point to make a move around the friggin' tanker truck, and it's super close, and I can see. I go, dude, I grab at the wheel, and I'm like, don't do that again. Stop driving so aggressively, man. There's a lot of people in the car. And the people, when we got out, were like, oh, my God, thank God you said something. We were shitting ourselves back there. But that's kind of always been my mentality, is not to be a jerk, but just to be question authority. Question, like, just because you say it so doesn't mean that I have to accept that. And, yeah, they bust all the kids up, and everything was good.
Do you think that comes from a particular incident in your childhood where you're resilient against that, and you can, because it's common sense, isn't it?
Yeah.
But you just got to speak it up.
Well, as a kid, I wouldn't have done that. I learned that behavior as I got older. I knew what it was like to be a coward, a quitter, and go with the flow. And at some point in my life, especially coming out of my addiction, I also realized, like, I'm not a victim. I'm not going to go with the flow. I'm not a jerk, but I'm also not a pushover. Mm. And didn't make sense to me, so I called him on his bullshit,
which is good. On the you said that when you went to New York that you put the donkey dust down,
yeah,
for the job. How was that? Because I know myself that I always put money first before anything. For the first 8 years I was a model, and for the first 8 years of my career I traveled didn't stay in one country for more than 2 months. I was always knocking on doors. When we did show season in Paris, I'm like, that's done, let's go to Milan, then we'll go to Germany or wherever. And I was always on the move. And I always looked at other people thinking, they put their feet up really early and like, oh, we've had a break, we've earned some money. And I just had this thing where I'm like, nope, let's go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And you sound like a fine example of that.
Yeah.
But when you went to New York, you said you put down the cocaine for your job. How did that process work?
I never really wanted to do coke unless I was drinking. Yeah. I wouldn't have a problem saying, like, no way, I'm not doing cocaine, because I'm gonna ruin the rest of the weekend. I won't be able to, like, I'd see the sun come up and want to kill myself. I'd be like, oh, you stupid son of a bitch, you just ruined an entire day. I'm gonna have to sleep all day, and I'm gonna wake up, I'm gonna feel like crap. Because then I would, the longer I'd stay awake doing coke, the more I'd be drinking. It was like poisoning myself. Mm. And I realized if I could stop drinking, I wouldn't crave to do cocaine. So I stopped drinking for a while, and it wasn't that hard. It's like, cocaine sucks. It's like the big lie. The happiest time doing cocaine is when you first make the phone call, like, tell the guy to come. I was almost more high anticipating it. Then I would do it. I'd be happy for like 5 minutes, and then it would just slowly get worse. To the point where I'm like, oh my God, I'm having anxiety. I have to go home and go to bed. Is there more coke left? Okay, I can put off that feeling. And it would just like prolong the inevitable. It just sucks.
It's so funny because it is the phone call that's the bit where he's so excited. It's like, yeah, we're in. He's coming. He's coming to clear the table. And you're right. It goes downhill from that.
Fast.
And I think if those our listeners haven't done cocaine yet, it's literally that. It's about, it's this subconscious feeling about, you know, you're going to feel better in a minute.
Yes.
And it's the excitement. It's almost like winning a match.
But the thing is, when you do it the first time, it's awesome. So are opioids, and I'm sure heroin's probably great too. Otherwise, people wouldn't do it again. That's the problem.
Mm.
That, yeah, it's like, it's lying to you. It's telling you that this is the answer, when in fact it's the like worst thing you could do.
It's the biggest lie ever.
The thing you're trying to mask by doing the drugs, the problem, the emotion and feeling you're trying to escape by doing drugs, is just getting pushed further, deeper into a hole. You're going to have to dig yourself out of it eventually.
We had Ollie Ollerton on here, who's an ex-SAS, SBS guy, really cool guy. Started a TV program called Who Dares Wins. It's an SAS thing where people go on trials. And we had a very similar story about how we gave up. And I just read this quote about a buffalo. that in a storm, a buffalo on the plains is the only animal that will turn to it because it knows it will be relieved on the other side.
And the cow goes with the storm.
Exactly, yeah. And he had that tattoo on his body because that was his thing.
Mm.
And that's what I always say with people is that it's this... I never wanted to be an addict. I never thought about being it. I actually wanted to be the opposite. I don't blame you. Yeah. And you don't see it. For me, it's like, it's always glamorized in TV movies and stuff and how people talk about it. But it's like you only see the red carpet at a movie. You don't see the 5 years preparation, the acting, the studying. Same as training. You don't see all the training at 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, rain, and it's horrible. And then... It's the same with addiction for me. You only see the good bits, and 99.9% is horrendous. Because for me, I was trying to escape the way I felt.
Yeah.
Then, because I got higher with stuff, but then it was just trying to feel somewhat normal.
Mm.
Is that what the Percocets were for you?
Oh yeah, you very quickly become physically addicted, and if you don't take them, you start to get sick. And if you take them, you know, like you hear sometimes drug addicts talk about getting well. Like if you saw the movie Get Him to the Greek with Russell Brand, he's trying to get heroin and Jonah Hill's trying to get it from him. He's like, you threw away my medicine. Now you have to help me get well. And it's like, you know, the heroin is the medicine.
Yeah.
To call it getting a fix. It's getting your health fixed because... You've never felt pain like withdrawals from opioids.
How did, when did you first realize that? Because I know you said about your uncle, you saw him with that. It's hard to understand when something's prescribed by a doctor or a pharmaceutical thing, that it's cleaner, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's a legal drug, so obviously it's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
When did you first realize that, fucking hell, this is probably a bad thing?
When I moved to London, I had been doing drugs for probably around a year every single day. And when I moved to London, I was like, you know what? I'm not going to do these drugs anymore. I knew what I was doing was wrong. And I came to London without the drugs. And holy shit, did I get sick. And that's when I called my younger brother and said, hey, go find, call so-and-so and get me like X amount of like Oxycontins and send them over here. And of course, I was like, you know, keep 50 for yourself or whatever. And so he sent them over and I was like off to the races. And then I would eventually found like a shady doctor in London that would prescribe me Oxycontin.
Yeah, there's a lot of shady doctors.
It was crazy. I mean, you know, anytime you pay a doctor cash, you know, a lot of them, you can get them to write a prescription for whatever you want. Now everything is much more tightly regulated. But back then when I was in London, the doctor didn't even know what I was asking for. He was like, let me get my prescribing manual out. He's like, oh, Oxycontin, huh? I've never heard of this. And I didn't even know we have this in this country. Yeah, here you go, here's 100. The pharmacist was like, oh, I got to order that. We don't stock that, but I can order it. And I was like, yeah, okay, cool.
Funny, isn't it? We're quite behind over here.
Yeah, and it came in blister packs. Like in the U.S., if you go to a pharmacy, the pills are all loose. They pour them out. They count them in a little counter and put them in a jar. Here, everything, all the prescription were in blister packs. You pop it out of the tinfoil vac. Yeah. It was just interesting that it was so different. It makes sense so that someone's not touching the pills, because a lot of medicine, like fentanyl, if you touch it and you don't use those kind of drugs, you can go into a rapid overdose.
Which is mad, isn't
crazy
it?
Crazy strong drugs. Yeah. Yeah, the fentanyl that like coming out of Mexico, the Chinese are sending the components over to Mexico. It's getting mixed, and then the cartels are shipping it up over the border, and it's crazy expensive. And they're putting it in cocaine, which is why a lot of people are overdosing. And like I know Kid Rock, was a big coke user, now talks about like they don't do coke because they put fentanyl in it. And if you're not a fentanyl user and you take a little bit of fentanyl, like you can overdose. That's why I like this drug Narcan, which reverses the effects of an overdose. You spray it up someone's nose. It's so prominent. Like even at my house, we have a thing of Narcan because so many people are overdosing because fentanyl can find its way into anything.
Yeah.
And no one in my house uses drugs. But what if someone comes to my house and is like, you don't know what your neighbors are into. It's like having one of those defibrillators. Like if you have a defibrillator, you can save like some huge percentage of people that have a heart attack, for instance. But if you don't have that and you wait for the ambulance to come back to shock them to when someone's heart stops. It's the difference between life and death. Mm-hmm. There was a big special about it in kids' sports, because sometimes kids in intense workouts, their heart can stop. It's just, it's like this weird thing that sometimes happens to teenagers. But the sports programs and the sports trainers that have access to the IED, if you can hit them with an IED quickly, there's some crazy stat about survival rates. So we have IED, like all this stuff that I hope I never need. But if I do, we have it. But Narcan is so prevalent. Like you can buy it in vending machines and clubs. And I have a bunch of friends who are like big, giant rock stars, like big name people. And I've been backstage with them and the band members were like, oh, I forget what they were doing, but I said, what is that? They're like, oh, it's testing strips. I'm like, for what? They're like, oh, if you have coke, you know, because they're traveling all that. It's like, if you get coke, you test it with this strip to make sure it doesn't have fentanyl in it.
Wow.
I'm like, that's pretty resourceful drug addict.
That is pretty resourceful,
but
probably necessary.
Yeah,
now,
but if you don't want to die,
yeah,
because that stuff's serious. Like, you remember a couple years ago, handful of people in LA died in like the kind of like model hipster scene.
Yeah.
They were all doing coke laced with fentanyl.
Yeah,
and I think that the intention in the with the drug dealers is fentanyl. If you know, if you've done the right therapeutic dose, it makes you feel good.
Yeah.
So they're mixing it in with cocaine and getting people hooked on the like cocaine and fentanyl at the same time.
It's really bad. It's just coming over here now, actually, and it's yeah, I know it's absolutely crazy. A guy showed just how much fentanyl you need to kill yourself, and it's like a dust thing. It's like grain of sand.
If you don't use those kind of drugs and you get exposed to them, you can die. You know the movie, I always think about the movie Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
When she finds the heroin in his pocket and she thinks it's coke,
yeah,
and she does the equivalent of a line of coke in heroin and immediately overdoses. Yeah, that's what happens. Like confusing cocaine with heroin would be very difficult, but the equivalent amounts are so, the heroin is so much more expensive and so much more deadly. But I thought that scene was so great, because as she's doing it, I'm like, oh no, she thinks that's coke. And he's shooting heroin earlier, and he bought a huge bag of heroin. Like people usually buy like little tiny bags of heroin. He buys like a friggin' ounce of heroin. I'm like, well, that's a lot of heroin. But when she snorts that heroin, it immediately goes into rapid withdrawal. And then they hit her with the adrenaline. It's just, the scene was so good. But it's funny, I know not many people that don't understand drugs just think that she overdosed on cocaine, and I'm like, no.
No, yeah, exactly.
Such a good scene.
That I was with a couple of girls once in a toilet in a hotel in London.
And I'm sure, like with your handsome good looks, you were in a lot of toilets with a lot of women. Fashion model in New York and LA. I'm like, jeez, I'm so jealous. I wish I was handsome.
Oh, you're right in that area, I tell you.
No.
This girl put a line out, and I did it, and I woke up on the floor about 2 hours later, and it was ketamine. I had no idea. I thought it was coke.
Just really? Run. I've done like ketamine, like therapeutic ketamine. I didn't know it like rendered you unconscious.
Oh, yeah, no, so you get a K-hole.
No, I knew there was a K-hole, but I didn't know that it would like knock you out.
Oh, yeah, no, I was on the floor. I was done. I was completely on the floor out, like completely gone. I was like, what did this girl poison me? I had no idea what it was.
That's awesome.
We have a huge problem here with in our school talk program.
By the way, one quick thing. We're glamorizing and kind of goofing about drugs, but I'm telling you right now, drugs are for losers.
Yeah.
I've never felt so bad about myself. And when I finally got sober, I was going to get sober or I was going to kill myself. And I am not a suicidal person, and I didn't want to end my life. I wanted to live, but I was very close to committing suicide because I couldn't get off these drugs.
Yeah.
And I couldn't even do it for myself. I had to eventually do it for my wife and my future children that I hadn't even met yet. So if you think that what I'm saying sounds sexy or attractive, then I've done a disservice in describing my experience, because it was a fucking nightmare. I put myself in a terrible position, and it's my proudest achievement in life is getting sober. So of all the things that I've won and all the races that I've won and things that I've achieved and the book, that all pales in comparison to the pride I feel of being able to get off drugs. And even that isn't easy. It hasn't been a perfect journey, but I'm not using drugs today.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. No, we laughed, but it wasn't. I don't think we was glamorizing it.
Yeah.
I think there's a big different thing, because It's an awful thing. We do have a ketamine problem here with young kids because it's so cheap. And there's more girls now losing their bladder or being on a colostomy bag within 2 months of using it because it's £5 a bag, like $7 a bag.
What does it do to your bladder?
If you get a brain out on a table, yeah, it creases it up. It cramps and creases your bladder up.
Oh, really?
So most people end up with 10% of a normal bladder.
Wow.
So one of the guys, he was on our podcast, who does our conversations in the school, has like 10 or 20% left of his bladder. He's a young man, was a soccer player, boxer, very, very fit guy.
How much ketamine was he using?
No, you don't have to do loads. He was using a lot himself, but you don't have to use loads.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty bad stuff.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. When you finally done that incredible achievement of being sober, did you get any therapy or go to a 12-step program, or was it you that just turned the switch off?
I had done a little bit of everything on and off. When I was living in London, I went through like a Narcotics Anonymous program, and that was massively helpful. I just went to the meetings. I never really worked the program, as they say, or worked the steps, but I would go to the meetings and find solace in companionship and, like, you know, sharing similar struggles with other people, and you realize you're not alone and that other people are going through this. So that was, you know, very helpful. But then I, later in life, when I after I won a bunch of races and realized I wasn't any different or wasn't any happier than I was before, I went to a inpatient trauma healing center, basically like an inpatient in-depth intensive psychotherapy facility. That was very hard to do. Like, I did not want to go there. I was like driving there like I was going to the electric chair. I was like, what the fuck am I doing? I can't believe I'm doing this. But it's like anything. It's like getting up and running. It's like, you know what needs to be done. We all know what's ailing us. Like, you know, when people are like, I don't know, what should I do? I'm like, you know exactly what to do. I'm overweight. I want to lose weight. Stop eating so much and exercise more. The end. There's no magic pill. There's no secret formula. I mean, now I guess there is a magic pill with Ozempic, but the point is, like, we all know what we need to do. It's just a matter of being willing or being able. We're all able to do anything we want. You could be a fucking astronaut if you want. You can get a PhD in neuroscience. You can do anything. The question is, are you willing to do the work required to get what you want? Period.
That's the bottom line, isn't it? You can have a whole narration for yourself. I don't think Ozempic is the answer, because now there's a lot of stuff saying that it's not. I don't think you can get healthy. You can get skinny with it.
There are no shortcuts.
There's no shortcuts. You have to do what you have to do.
That's it.
When you were free, when you finally got free of the opioids and stuff, how did that feel? Because for me, that's my biggest achievement. My kids, actually, having healthy kids. But to get over the addiction, when I finally made that decision, I mean, it was incredibly emotional. And I did a similar thing in Arizona, maybe what you did.
Yeah.
And although it was tremendously painful, I felt this unbelievable power and freedom of I'm literally, people say rock bottom, I'm there now. I'm in the devil's belly and I'm feeling all the pain, all the thoughts and the whole thing. But I felt like, I don't like being sick, but when you're sick, vomiting, after and after and after, you feel better and better and better.
Yeah.
And that was how it felt for me. And it was, and I actually sometimes sit and try and feel those feelings that I had at that moment. This was 20 years ago. Best thing I ever done, most empowering, free thing I've ever done. And I know I'm still growing. We're the same age, but I'm still growing, still learning. And but that for me was the absolute turning point. How was it for you mentally that you finally stopped taking stuff?
It took a while to get to a good place. Like I said, it was years after I stopped using the drugs that I went to that trauma healing center. Unfortunately, I didn't, it wasn't like instantaneous feeling good. It was just like I was a sober addict. You know, I was like, I was sober, but I wasn't like fully like recovered. So it was always there, like looming in the background. And to a certain extent, it still feels like that a lot today. It's like, I don't want to discourage people from getting sober, but it's just, you know, it hasn't been easy. It's a grind.
Yeah.
It's a grind. But, you know, I distract myself with work and endeavors, and I try to find like a release or relief in other types of achievements and accomplishments, and use that avoidance of going back to the person I was as motivation to become the person that I want to be.
Yeah. How do you deal with feelings and thoughts and emotions today when you read about yourself? Like when I read about it, I was like, oh, fucking hell, he's going to be intimidating because he's got a long list of achievements here, like a long list. And you've done stuff that most men couldn't do. You know,
well, I think they can. They just haven't tried.
I don't know. I mean, doing 155 miles across the desert on your own with a 20-pound bag.
I did it 1 mile at a time. I didn't think of it as 150 miles. I thought of it as how far is today? 21 miles? Okay. Yeah. Let's get through the first few miles, see how we feel, adjust accordingly. And I just took it like the journey of 1,000 miles starts with a step. And that's how I looked at it. I was like, yeah, I was going there shitting myself. Like, why did I sign up for this? And I had brands sponsoring me. Like, you know, I was like, man, this is like what a professional athlete feels like. Like other people are paying me to do these things so they can be like, yeah, we're on Ken's team. And I'm like, oh my God, I don't even want to be on my team. Then you just turn up and you just start getting after it. And then it, you know, it's like what fighters describe. It's like you're super nervous. Then punches start flying. You start getting hit and all of a sudden you're into your zone and you're like, all right, I've been here before. That's what it was.
That's the Gobi Desert, right? For yeah. People who don't know. How you said in your book about how do you prepare for this? You did it in like 4 weeks, by the way. Well, most people do it for years.
But. Yeah, people prepared for a couple years maybe, but I had been running 10 plus miles a day for years, and I knew that what more could I have done? Like run 20 miles a day? Like I wouldn't be able, no one can recover from that. That's, those kind of races are there. You go there in shape by running like, you know, 100 miles a week, whatever it is. And then you empty the tank. Everyone is in the same boat. No one can put in like the kind of miles that are going to be required on race day. So I figured no one could have trained more overall than I have. I don't know anyone that runs more than that. So I was like, they're not going to have any superhuman strength. They're going to be just like me. They might know more, but I don't think they'll be more fit when it comes to running. So I just turned up and started getting after it. And it was like, it was crazy in hindsight. I can't believe I did it. Even all the things, when you say like all these things you accomplished, I'm like, holy shit, I did a lot of things. But, you know, in a lot of ways, it was all survival. I was just going through life like, oh, shit, let me run a marathon. Oh, wow, I bet I can do it this fast. And it was never like, yeah, I'm going to show everyone. I'm going to do all these impressive achievements. Because if that was the case, I'd be like, let me tell you all the things I'm going to do next. I'm going to go to Mars. I'm going to go over here. And I'm going to cure cancer. Like,
What I said earlier. It's different about talking for something, but you've done stuff.
Yeah.
But very eloquently, you talk about fear and nerves and things openly in your book, but and also ironically, like the fear of putting down drugs because of the pain. But to do that is, you know, I do running, but nothing like that. What did you take with you first of all? Because I wanted to know, because you said you tried to prepare about taping bottles of water and stuff like that. How do you do that physically? Is in the sense of, what do you take? And you sleep in tents, right, on that, in the desert run?
Yeah, you have to carry a backpack with all the food you need for a week, plus mandatory safety equipment. So it's about 20 pounds, about 10 kilos on your back. So I was training with different trying to find a backpack that worked, because, you know, you're running really far in the desert. The thing is rubbing your shoulders and your waist. And you get there and you have to run. Every day is like 20 to 30 miles for 4 days, for 3 days, then the fourth day is a 50-mile stage, which just under 100 kilometers. And then there's a 26-mile stage and then a 6-mile stage. So as we're going through the first day, I got blown out. I came in fourth, but I'm thinking I'm going to win. Yeah, so I was in a tent with four girls, and initially, you know, they were like, who the hell's this guy in the tent with us? Because I had signed up late, so they just stuck me in the tent with the girls. it was funny because at the end of each day, you know, I change, we'd be changing our clothes and stuff. And I was like super polite to the girls, right? I'm like, guys, I'm going to stand over here. Like, I didn't have a towel with me. Everything I had, you had to carry. So I was like, hey, I'm going to stand over here in the corner and change. And after the second or third day, they're like, no one's looking at you, dude. You don't have to tell us every time you're changing. And then they're like, we were in here with a German guy 1 year, and the guy was naked the whole time, pissing in a water bottle. I'm like, what an animal. But yeah, it was just, it was full of adventures, and it was really, I mean, I hesitate to say it was fun, but then like I say, on the 50 mile stage, it was me and a Swiss guy who was awesome. Like, if we race 10 times, that guy's gonna beat me 9. But same like winning the world championships in the marathon, like the two guys who I beat in Chicago when I won the world championships for the age group, the guys that came in second and third should have beat me. They both had run several minutes faster than I've ever run the same year as the race. But on that day, they had issues. I didn't, and I beat them by both by less than a minute. So in the Gobi Desert, when the guy fell apart on the 50-mile stage, I ended up winning that stage by 90 minutes, and then I won the overall race by 90 minutes. It was...
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, it was crazy.
That's experience. So phenomenal. How do you... have you had any ailments from the running you're doing? Because to push through, nothing at all.
No.
That's phenomenal. I find that crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I find that amazing.
I just keep doing it. You know, like once you start to get to know your body, like I've had little aches and pains, and I go see a physical therapist. They tell me what to do, and I just fix it.
Yeah.
But I've got every single device known to man. Like I've got electrical muscular stimulation. I've got heat, cold plunge, sauna. I've got everything at my house. Like that's the one thing I'm like most proud of. I've got a gym in my house that's as nice as like a Gold's Gym. I have Rogue everything, kettlebells, weights, Sisu sauna, Primal Ice cold plunge, like red lights, everything. I don't really use everything as much as I should, but yeah, man, you got to take care of yourself.
For me, there's a message in there as well, right? Is that you got to take care of yourself. So coming from the beginning of your story, all for that adversity, all the stuff we spoke about. Well, there's so much in the book. We could talk for hours about it. There's so much detail in the book. But I find it a privilege to talk to someone who's a real man's man that now takes care of himself, has all that stuff, who is a brilliant father, looks after his kids, you know. And I think your she's incredible through the book as well. Like, you're lucky to have a lovely lady like that as well. For our listeners, for someone who is in their 40s or 50s, two questions. If they have addiction problems or drink problems, stuff like that, what should you do? And the second question is, there's this real ageist thing about, I'm in my 50s, I'm about to slow down, or in my 60s. You look like, you know, you're not at all at physically like you're in the 30s. So two questions. What would you say about the addiction? And second of all, what would you say about someone who's like, I'm getting old, I'm getting
I say the same thing to both of them. Cut the shit. Get to work. Like, you know what you need to do. How's the addiction working out for you? It's like I tell people, you acknowledge that you can't do this on your own, right? So ask for help. Go get the help you need. Like when I was not happy with my mental health, I went and did something about it. It wasn't easy. But I don't have sympathy for people that don't want to do something about it. Like you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink it. And it's like, dude, there's such a better life out there. Look at other people that you admire. If you admire others, I guarantee they're sober. And guys who are in their later years, in their 50s, and they think it's all over, like, good. Keep telling yourself that. Whatever you think about yourself is true. It's more like wins for guys like us that still want to get after it. But, you know, whatever you think about yourself, it's true. You think you're old? Okay, you're old. I don't think I'm old. I'm just like, I'm doing it. I hate saying how old I am because I'm like, holy shit, I'm old. But I don't feel old. I'm doing the same things I was doing. Sometimes it takes a little longer to recover, but the minute you like get off of the stop growing and accelerating is the minute you start decelerating and going in reverse. And I just refuse to accept any of that. There's a ton of data and research to suggest that until you're in your 70s is really physically when your body really starts to break down, that you can't do it anymore. I honestly believe that people just start giving up as opposed to staying aggressive with their regimen. And if you do, I think genuinely, like if you look at the times of the age group world champions in like sprinting and stuff, that's what the study was done on, like track times. And really, you don't see a significant drop off until 70 for the guys that get after it. So, you know,
to get after it,
you have to take care of your mental and physical health like your life depends on it, because it does.
Ken, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, brother. Appreciate you, man.
Yeah, really good.
Thank you.
This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scolfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up, and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eberlong, who does all the hard work in the background, and the rest of the team.